21. And so the passage begins, Jehoash was 7 years old when he began to reign. Now this Jehoash is the same person referred to as Joash in the previous passage. The ESV footnote points that out. I'm going to keep on calling him Joash, seeing as you're used to that now from the last sermon. And this statement then about him becoming king at 7 years old, I suppose if you weren't here last time and if you aren't familiar with 2 Kings 11, your reaction may be, crumbs, that's awfully young. The rest of you will appreciate, however, that he's actually 6 years older than he might well be. He was only 1 year old when his father died and vacated Judah's throne, but he didn't become king at that point. In fact, he very nearly didn't live beyond that point. He was narrowly rescued by an aunt from his infanticidal grandmother. He was then hidden away until he could be safely given the crown, hence this eventual coronation now when he's 7 years old. And after that notification of the beginning of Joash's reign, we then, in the next verse of our passage, provided a couple of biographical data, the length of Joash's reign, 40 years, and the identity of his mother, Zibiah of Beersheba. But it's what we're told after that, in the following verse, that's of most interest. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days. And I said last time, that that is no small thing. It's been a while since such a statement could be made of a king of Judah. Remember, I also said actually that Athaliah, in God's strange ways, played a part in making this grandson she tried to kill a good king. And this evening, then, I don't want to undermine all that positive stuff about Joash. It is indeed hugely welcome that we have here a good king after a run of not-so-good kings. We must do full justice to that. However, I want to say this. Joash was a good king. He was not a perfect king. Now, some of you who know your Bibles well may be thinking, we know what you're getting at, Dan. You have in mind 2 Chronicles 24, which parades rather graphically Joash's imperfections. Actually, I'm not much concerned with that passage. If I ever get round to preaching through 2 Chronicles, then I will be concerned with it. But my task this evening is to handle this passage, and this passage doesn't parade Joash's imperfections graphically. But imperfections are evident in 2 Kings 12 nonetheless. And in that connection, I want to particularly focus on what happens in verses 17 and 18. There we read, at that time, Hazael, king of Syria, went up and fought against Gath, the Philistine city, and took it. But when Hazael set his face, having conquered Gath, to go up against Jerusalem, Jehoash, king of Judah, or Joash, took all the sacred gifts that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah his fathers, the kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred gifts, and all the gold that was found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent these to Hazael, king of Syria. Then Hazael went away from Jerusalem. And I want to ask, why does Joash act in that way? At one level, of course, the answer is obvious. It's a strategy to preserve Jerusalem from attack, and as such, it works. Jerusalem is not attacked. But you know what I mean by the question I'm asking. I'm asking, how is it that King Joash is prepared to ransack Yahweh's temple and bequeath its treasures to this pagan wretch? How is it? And in answering that, I want to draw your attention to 3 things. And first of all, then, the tendency in Joash's character. The tendency in Joash's character. Now, you probably picked up from what I said just then that I don't think Joash does the right thing in verse 18. His strategy to ward off Hazael might be pragmatically savvy, but I don't think it's honorable. I don't think it's righteous. I don't think it's principled. Now, you are evangelical Christians who are big on what the text actually says. And so you might be thinking, but Dan, the narrator passes no judgment on Joash's actions in verse 18. Joash's ancestor David slept with Uriah's wife and arranged the termination of Uriah's life, and the narrator stated unequivocally at the end of it all, the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. We don't have any statement here, the thing that Joash had done displeased the Lord. Your assessment of his actions, therefore, is entirely subjective, you might be thinking. It's an assumption you're making that is unsupportable in terms of the text. You might well be thinking that. So let me defend myself. Biblical narrators have more than one way of communicating approval or disapproval. Yes, they can make unequivocal statements like that one about David, but they can also use subtler means. And that's what this narrator here does. I'll show you what I mean. Which characters in this passage are clearly portrayed unfavorably? The priests. The priests are clearly portrayed unfavorably. It's unmistakable. In verse 5, they are commissioned by Joash to do two things, two verbs, take and repair. They are to take this money, described in verse 4, that rightfully belongs to the house of the Lord, and they are to repair the house of the Lord itself, its parts that are dilapidated and not fit for purpose. And the priests then fail. You can't miss that. But this is the thing. They don't disregard the entirety of Joash's commission, just half of it. So that in verse 7, Joash asks them, why are you not repairing? He doesn't ask them, why are you not taking? Because they're doing the taking bit of what he'd asked them to do. They're hot on that side of things. They're not holding back when it comes to taking. That's why Joash continues in verse 7, now therefore, take no more money. And notice, by the way, the narrator prevents us from feeling sorry for the priests, as though these poor guys have been asked by Joash to divert to a building fund money which they desperately need to feed their own families, so that you can hardly blame them for what they do. No. Verse 16. The money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offerings was not brought into the house of the Lord. It belonged to the priests. In other words, the priests had their own legitimate source of revenue. And so all this taking with no repairing, it wasn't because the alternative for them was starvation. It was because they were just a bad lot. They were takers. Simple as that. Such incorrigible takers, indeed, that in verses 8 and 9, Joash has to implement two radical measures. Number one, relieve the priests of all their responsibilities in relation to this project. And number two, ensure that from now on, money belonging to the house of the Lord was contained in a chest, which for maximum security was both publicly situated and difficult to get into. Just a hole bored into it. So I'm saying we have these characters in the passage, the priests, who are clearly portrayed unfavorably. And it's against that backdrop then that the narrator describes Joash's actions in verse 18. And what does he say? Jehoash, king of Judah, took. Same verb that's been used so often in verses 5 to 8. Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred gifts that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his fathers, the kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred gifts, and all the gold that was found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord. What is Joash doing? He's taking money that rightfully belongs to the house of the Lord. That is to say, he's behaving just like the priests. The narrator doesn't need a statement like the one in that David passage. He doesn't need to express his disapproval of Joash in that very obvious, unequivocal way. Instead, he simply places Joash's actions alongside the actions of this undeniably dodgy bunch of guys, the priests, and allows the scary resemblance between the two sets of actions to tell their own story. Now, my heading is the tendency in Joash's character. What am I getting at there? Well, I would put it to you, Joash has the tendency to be influenced by others. He's impressionable, we might say. He's easily led. And there's something interesting in that tendency in Joash. It's both an advantage and a disadvantage, an asset and a liability, a strength and a weakness. So in verse 2, where the influence to which he's susceptible is that of the high priest Jehoiada, who's godly, Joash's tendency is a strength. He soaks up Jehoiada's godliness and behaves like him. But in verses 4 to 18, where the influence to which he's susceptible is that of the other priests who are unscrupulous, Joash's tendency is a weakness. He soaks up their unscrupulousness and behaves like them. And there's a general point here then that I think is worth noting. We need to be aware tendencies which serve us really well in some areas of the Christian life, those very same tendencies can be our downfall in other areas of the Christian life. Listen to Ted Donnelly on this point. He writes this: we sometimes imagine that our vices are the polar opposite of our virtues. We can identify certain good qualities in our characters, strengths which we have reason to think we possess. There are also flaws of which we are painfully aware. It may seem to us that these are far removed from each other, with our personal pluses and minuses having nothing in common. But this may not be the case. Our strengths and our weaknesses may be neighbours, not strangers. He continues, we need to be warned that Satan is devious enough to make use of not only our weaknesses, but our strengths. A man blessed with the ability to express himself fluently may be tempted to speak rashly. A woman's sympathy for those who are broken and hurting may make her too indulgent towards sin. Sensitivity may degenerate into self-pity, determination into stubbornness. The intelligent may misuse their minds to become arrogant or unbelieving instead of to love God. Warm-heartedness is a valuable quality, but not when it betrays us into temper tantrums. We may covet the ability to remain calm under pressure, but such serenity sometimes freezes into callousness. There is scarcely a gift which the devil cannot pervert. It is right that we should be loyal to all that is best in our Christian tradition. But when adherence to the old ways turns into blinkered conservatism, terrified of any change, it becomes a prison instead of a foundation. We are called to be intelligently aware of the world in which we live, like the children of Issachar, who had understanding of the times. Yet studying the world too much can lead to conforming to it. Healthy commitment to the branch of the church to which we belong can turn into sectarianism. A love of seeing that all things are done decently and in order can make us suspicious of genuine religious spontaneity and enthusiasm. The list of Satan's wiles is endless. And so I ask you, are you vigilant regarding your strengths? Are you vigilant regarding your strengths? That may sound a bit silly and a bit of an excessive question to ask. Vigilant regarding your strengths. But Joash shows us we need to be vigilant regarding our strengths. So there's that general point, but there's also a more specific application here, which is this. We need to be those who are both susceptible to the good examples around us and resistant to the bad examples around us. You see, The ideal is not a headstrong, cynical kind of attitude whereby we won't learn from others. No. There are Jehoiadas in our church and on our bookshelves whom we need to learn from. But nor is the ideal a weak, chameleon kind of disposition whereby we are shaped by whatever influences we happen to be exposed to. No, there are people in our schools and our workplaces and on TV and on social media who, like the priests in this passage, could seriously disfigure our characters. As Paul puts it, bad company corrupts good character. What is the ideal then? It's that discernment, that mature discernment that can switch between impressionableness when that's appropriate and cynicism and rejection when that's appropriate. It's Romans 12 verse 9, hate what is evil, cling to what is good. May God help us to balance those two things which Paul speaks of there. So we're asking the question, why does Joash do what he does there in verse 18 of our passage? And I'm saying that there's this tendency in Joash's character to be influenced. And that can be good when it's a Jehoiada to whom he's exposed. But it can be bad when it's guys like these priests to whom he's exposed. The tendency in Joash's character. But then notice with me, secondly, the tension between Joash's policies. The tension between Joash's policies. Now, you might be thinking, okay, we get that point then about Joash being impressionable and taking his cue from these priests who just blithely took money belonging to the house of the Lord. But even so, even allowing for all that, it seems just such a strange U-turn from the pro-temple policy which Joash pursues so fervently up until verse 18. There it's all about directing funds to the temple. That's what those verses are all about. He's so assiduously directing more and more funds to the temple. It's the very opposite of ransacking the place. He's so into the temple. And then he goes and does this in verse 18. But actually, Joash's pro-temple policy isn't quite as clear-cut prior to verse 18 as a cursory glance at the passage might suggest. Certainly, he does expend serious effort and energy in the renovation program, and to a point, I'm sure he does that with genuine enthusiasm. But look at verse 3. We've been told in verse 2, Jehoash or Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. And then verse 3 continues, nevertheless, the high places were not taken away. The people continued to sacrifice and make offerings on the high places. Now, the high places were locations which, before Israel inherited the promised land, had been used by Canaan's pagan inhabitants for their worship. And these locations then, apart from at one or two points in Old Testament history, they continued to be used by Canaan's new inhabitants, by Yahweh's people. In bad times, they were used by Yahweh's people for idolatrous worship. In better times, when a good king like Joash was on the throne, they were used for the worship of Yahweh himself, which was still unsatisfactory, however. Hence the unmistakable negative tone that we have in verse 3 here. It seems unlikely, it doesn't seem quite negative enough to allow for the people of Judah to be actually worshipping pagan gods at these high places. But it's negative nonetheless, isn't it? And it's negative then, it's unsatisfactory that they are worshipping Yahweh at these high places, because by this point, Jerusalem should have had a monopoly. As one writer puts it, the critique relates to a failure to centralize the worship of God in the temple in Jerusalem rather than to a failure to eradicate idolatry as such. So verse 3 then, it doesn't warrant us condemning Joash as an idolater, but certainly we can say his turning a blind eye to these high places isn't very pro-temple. It isn't very pro-temple at all. And so you see then what I mean by this second heading of mine, this tension between Joash's policies. His pro-temple policy is compromised and undermined by this policy regarding the high places. And this is the thing. For a long time, that doesn't seem to matter all that much, because he remains passionate about the temple despite the compromise. There he is, busily organizing all these renovations of the Jerusalem temple. But then, you see, then a crisis comes along. The crisis in verse 17. Hazael and his Syrian troops marching, advancing toward the city of Jerusalem. A crisis comes along, and in the face of the crisis, his pro-temple policy, having been already undermined, now unravels altogether. And he's happy to go in and ransack the temple of all its treasures. And I think there's a principle here. And the principle is this. Areas of Christian conduct in which we're not rock solid are likely to crumble in the face of a crisis. Not before then, perhaps. Until the crisis comes, there may not seem to be any problem at all. But areas of Christian conduct in which we're not rock solid are likely to crumble in the face of a crisis. It's the opposite of what we observe in the life of Daniel. And when it came to prayer, in Daniel's life, he was rock solid, wasn't he? In ordinary, everyday life, he was rock solid when it came to prayer. It was conspicuous even to his enemies that he was. Thus, when a crisis suddenly came along one day, and prayer suddenly carried with it the threat of the lion's den, his commitment to prayer didn't crumble. It didn't unravel. It didn't fall apart. It hadn't been compromised and undermined previously. It had been rock solid. And so when the crisis blew up, it didn't unravel. And so, just a couple of examples then for ourselves. If you compromise in small ways your commitment to speaking truthfully, if you're willing to tell just the odd lie to your boss at work, perhaps, when it's convenient to do so, then when suddenly one day a crisis comes along and telling the truth is likely to incur a really significant cost, your commitment to speaking truthfully is probably going to crumble completely. At that point, already undermined. The crisis comes, it crumbles. If you compromise in small ways your commitment to the Lord's Day, sacrificing it for a friend's reunion here, for a day of sales shopping there, when a crisis comes along, and your sports club or the band that you play for says, from now on, our regular fixtures, our regular gigs are going to be on Sundays, you go along with that or you leave, your commitment to the Lord's Day is probably going to crumble at that point. Already undermined and weakened and compromised, the crisis comes and it crumbles. And the point is then, the application is that you and I need to seek to be as rock solid as we possibly can by the help of God's Spirit in every area of Christian conduct, so that we're ready, like Daniel was ready, when the crisis comes along. Joash wasn't ready, because his commitment to the temple actually had been undermined years back. That wasn't very evident for a long time because there were no crises, and so he was busy on renovations of the temple. But his pro-temple policy had been compromised, and the crisis came, and it crumbled. Let's be ready for crises as much as we possibly can by God's grace, preparing ourselves by solidifying our conduct across the board of our Christian lives. So why does Joash do what he does there in verse 18? Well, we've noted the tendency in Joash's character, and we've noted the tension between Joash's policies. But then let's notice thirdly and finally the trajectory of Joash's God. The trajectory of Joash's God. So when Joash first gets going then with this temple renovation project, you perhaps think that he's going to restore the temple to the glory of Solomon's original construction. But actually, even before we get to verse 18 and the crisis and Joash suddenly pouring out all the resources he's just been pouring in to the temple, even before we get to that point, it's already clear that there's going to be no return to the glory of Solomon's original construction here. I mean, a verse like verse 13 is rather deflating, isn't it? Where amidst all that is being done, we're told of what isn't being done. And we're told there that they were not made for the house of the Lord basins of silver, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, or any vessels of gold or of silver from the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. And so, yes, certain things were treated, certain things were focused on, certain things were renovated, but other things weren't. And the ransacking then that goes on in verse 18, it confirms what has already become clear. This is not going to be a restoration of the temple to its original Solomon glory. And at one level then, obviously that's a shame. It's a shame that the temple is not being restored to how it was in Solomon's day. At another level, however, this is part of a larger trajectory. A larger trajectory of temple decline. I mean, it never regains the glory of Solomon's original construction. Joash's ransacking of it here, when Hazael starts knocking on Jerusalem's door, that's not an isolated incident within the Old Testament. Other kings will similarly ransack the temple, and there can only be so many times in which it is ransacked before everything is gone for good, and there were several such ransackings then. And all of them, I suppose, are really just little previews of a day that's coming when Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian emperor, will truly ransack the temple of all its treasures that are still there then, and at the same time will in fact destroy the entire building. Yes, subsequently the temple will be rebuilt, but you know those latter books of the Old Testament and how then it certainly didn't recover the glory that it had had in Solomon's day. It was a somewhat pathetic shadow of its former self in its rebuilt form. And that was clear to all. And yes, later still, Herod will invest a lot in the Jerusalem temple so that, of course, in Jesus' day, the disciples can sit on the Mount of Olives and comment, wow, what grand stones are in the temple building. But the decline of the temple by then is manifesting itself in other ways, of course, and all the ways in which it's being used, which so provoke Jesus' wrath. And so I'm saying then there's this larger trajectory of decline, and Joash's ransacking of the temple here, it's just one point in that larger trajectory. And I will put it to you then that that larger trajectory of temple decline, it's necessary and it's God's own doing. That's why my heading is calling it God's trajectory. It's God's own doing. That is to say, the temple needed to decline. It had to decline. It had to recede in order to make way for a better temple of a different kind altogether. That one that we talked about a few weeks ago, you may remember, on a Sunday morning when I was preaching from Exodus. And I spoke that morning about the temple that Jesus himself would build. I remember I said that Jesus was going to be in that line of rulers from the tribe of Judah who would build a temple. And Jesus then was going to build a temple. And the old temple, the Jerusalem temple, it had to decline. It wasn't meant to kind of keep getting back to Solomon's glory days. It was meant to steadily, inexorably decline, because it was going to be superseded by a better temple, a very different kind of temple that Jesus was going to construct. We have, I think, just a tiny little hint, even here in our passage, of that better, very different temple that Jesus was going to instruct. Look at verses 11 to 15, and we have in those verses a very interesting juxtaposition. On the one hand, these materials that are very unimpressive. I already commented on verse 13 there, and the kind of slightly pathetic nature of that verse. And so there's this emphasis on these materials that are very, very unimpressive. But then on the other hand, there's an emphasis in verses 11 to 15 on something that's very impressive. What is that? People. Those unnamed people who in many ways are the heroes of this entire chapter, who come out completely positively, unlike anybody else really. Those unnamed people in verse 15, the kind of supervisors, see, that seems to be their role on the building project, who didn't need to be monitored and inspected closely because they dealt honestly. What a wonderful tribute to those men. They dealt honestly. And perhaps then in verses 11 to 15, we have a tiny intimation of the seismic shift that is coming. When Jesus will build a temple, not of materials, but of people. Little people who, like these guys here, are not important and eminent. So interesting how, you know, in 1 Corinthians 1 to 3, in 1 Corinthians 3, you have, don't you, that description. Paul says to the Corinthian church, you are the temple of the Holy Spirit. And he's already said, hasn't he, back in chapter 1, that when you were called, not many of you were noble. Not many of you were important. And that striking combination of ideas, Jesus building his temple of little people. You have it again in Ephesians, I guess, don't you? Because at the end of Ephesians chapter 2, you have an emphasis on the Ephesian church being built into a temple. And then just a bit later, you come to chapter 6, and Paul is addressing slaves in the Ephesian church. Jesus building his temple of little, unimportant people. And we have here then these little unimportant people, yet whose lives have been transformed so that they deal honestly. And that's what Jesus is building his temple out of. Little unimportant people whose lives he's transforming by his grace so that they are beautiful stones that are honest and pure and wholesome and kind and full of integrity. I just want to close in asking, are you part of that temple building? The building that Jesus is putting up? Are you one of those stones that he is fixing into walls of his edifice? A little person, perhaps. No great celebrity in this world. A little person. But a little person who's who is being transformed by the grace of God into something beautiful and being incorporated into this wonderful structure that's getting bigger and bigger until finally Jesus lays the last stone and then he comes. Are you part of that? May, by God's grace, every one of us be a stone in the building Jesus is putting up. Amen.